as a reporter, getting the story is the job. You have to go to the scene. You have to figure out who's going to give you the interviews, making a lot of phone calls. Sometimes a story happens and you are like, why didn't we know about this? When I was a crime reporter, you made beat calls. You just were supposed to be finding out. However you get these scoops and that secret phone call. You know, I started my career in television news. I had these big, big dreams. Never occurred to me I'd walk away. What are the things you're holding on to that you don't want to let go of? That question stayed with me, and it was life-changing.
Your net was to shine in the broadcasting industry and to be famous, to be known. Yeah.
You know, and on the surface it was, because when I asked my mom, I'm like, what are my nets?
Right.
You know? And my mom said, I think it's your desire to be famous. And I'm like, that's probably true. But I knew it was deeper than that. I don't want to be seen as super busy. I'd rather my life be seen as full.
What's my resume look like? How many people know who I am? How effective am I? Am I moving up the totem pole at my workplace? It takes time and big things to happen for you to get to a place where you're like, that stuff isn't the most important stuff in life.
I have to come to my own peace and figure out what forgiveness looks like for me. But it was hard.
It really seems to me, and this will probably be a tougher question to answer because you don't want to be braggy, but it seems like you learned some deep life truth that personally took me well into my 40s to learn. Wouldn't you agree that some of the stuff that you learn, you were given a gift of learning it at a very young age?
I think that's why I saw the book through, as hard as it was, because...
That makes sense, yeah.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or as a person?
Like you. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna lead. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
What were we even doing right now? In the back part of my mind, I had this gnawing feeling like I was running out of time, like I didn't have a right to be there enjoying myself when there was still so much to figure out. I didn't realize that the very thing I resisted, letting things be unresolved and relaxing into the moment, was the thing I needed most. I needed to awaken my senses and experience simple pleasures without shame or guilt for not doing something more productive with my life. All right, well, Happy New Year. The first episode of 2024, and that was a quote from Girl in the Spotlight by Angie Mazzell, a book encapsulating a story that we can all learn from. But folks in the Charleston area, you will love the setting of her story. It's right here in the Lowcountry. So do you ever slow down enough to ask yourself, am I living my life in a way right now that when I'm living my last day, I'll look back and be okay with? A lot of us, when we hear a question like that being satisfied on how our life panned out, many of our minds gravitate immediately to, man, I hope I will have accomplished much, you know, fulfilling big dreams, and maybe a dose of fame or wealth would be nice as well. And that right there is when we should pause and ask ourselves, if all of the things I think of as a good or successful life are all the things that I can't do anything with in the end, am I living for the right thing? So Angie was a local news anchor here in Charleston with big dreams of becoming well-known nationally as a news reporter. She was daggum good, so this wasn't a far-fetched notion. But you'll hear a story of an awakening that happened over time until the revelation was complete. Her dreams and what her whole life was being built around was all rooted in desires that would never lead to deep contentment and peace. It's a story of how she dared to lose this life she dreamed of in order to find the depths of her soul that would lead to the life that a good, good God made for her to have.
But Angie Mazzell. You're not nervous about this, right? You were in broadcasting, so this is like child's play, right? Or is it a little nerve-wracking?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is, but then the energy kind of moves through.
Yeah.
And I do think the cameras make it a little different. You know, it changes something about it. But
right.
I always wonder what it would be like to do radio. That seemed like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The times I've done radio interviews, there's something about the headsets that make you feel like you're saying important things.
Right. Right. So this is great because we haven't had too many guests outside of Seacoast that are local. Mm. And I'll describe kind of our connection. I consider us, we're like school fam. Mm-hmm. So I don't know you that well. I know about your family, just like you know about my family, because we've been seeing each other probably 5 times a year for the last 10 years.
That's right.
Because our kids are growing up in the same school. It really is like a school fam because you see the same people all the time. There's some people that I would even say, yeah, I kind of know them. I don't know their name, but yeah. I know I talk to them all the time.
Well, do you remember we played kickball one time?
I do remember that.
That was right. A lot of fun.
Yeah. Priscilla, it would make her so happy if I just planned one kickball party every year.
It was a blast.
It was.
And the knee socks, I was kind of, was it 70s or so? I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
All right. So I made a New Year's resolution and I've made it so far. My goal was to read, I think it was basically 100 pages a week.
Okay.
And so a lot of those were biographies. I'm going to show you the biographies that I read.
Okay.
So Coming of Age, Mississippi.
Okay.
She is actually one of the big time civil rights, but she doesn't have the name of like Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, unbelievable.
Okay.
Bill Russell.
Okay.
Charles Barkley.
All right.
All right. And you got Eugene Peterson, Ralph Macchio, Mo on the Three Stooges, and then Angie Mazzell.
And so one of these things is not like the other.
Oh, man. It was so neat reading this book, Angie, because not only is it really good, but it's like, I know this family, I know these people, but I don't know what is going to happen. Like, I knew that you were in broadcasting, but I didn't know what was going to happen. So it's definitely an autobiography, but there is an element to it of you want people to come away having learned something through your story. So it's almost like it's your life story, but also a very pinpointed theme. Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So it's actually, it is filed under biographies, but it's memoir is the genre. And it took me a while to learn this. But memoir is more of a slice of life. Like, it's not meant to be an autobiography or, so you have to decide what is the theme, what is the takeaway? And then you look at all these turning points in your life. And when I was going through the revision process, some things were added, other things were taken away, and not because it was less important in my life, but in the story I was telling, you know, not everything fits.
Yeah. So. What was the process? When did you first start the book? Now, having done it all, and you look back, like the idea came a long time ago.
The idea.
When did you actually start?
When did I start? I started when my freshman in high school son was in the womb. I'm not kidding. It's when I first went to a writing retreat, and it was all the way across the country in California. And it was a weekend of, you do a mind map?
Right.
In kind of visualizing your scenes, because you have to see scenes. It's not just stuff that happened in your head. What are things that happened? And I left with one or two scenes. So if you remember a scene where Sean and I are in Portland and I'm standing on the roof and I'm kind of like, I think I want this life. That scene has been there since the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I was not sitting at a typewriter, a laptop. Maybe I started so long ago.
My keyboarding class, sophomore year of high school, we had typewriters.
Right. Well, that's how I learned. But I guess at that point I had a laptop of some sort. But I was not there for 14 years. It was working on it, putting it away, working on it, putting it away, learning about how to write memoir.
Mm-hmm.
I write short form essay almost intuitively. But putting all of that in one, a book is very big. And so just to get it to where I could even see the whole story in my mind, I mean, it took a long time.
Yeah. There seems to be a uniqueness in how you, it's very effective, it's very moving, and it's like, Angie, do you not realize the bomb that you just dropped on us, and now you're moving on to something else? But it's not like you're being flippant about something, but it's, this is what it is, moving on. I'll read an example. This was the biggest bomb, Angie. During our early phone conversations, I learned that Sean had also grown up with a lot of loss. His dad died suddenly of a heart attack when Sean was 8. So this is your husband. It happened in the middle of the night a few weeks before Christmas when he and his sister woke up for school the next morning. The ambulance had already come and gone. Their mom broke the devastating news. His mom remarried once and quickly divorced. And like... Mm-hmm. Moving on to, then you start talking about more about Sean's personality and all that. But I read that and I was like, oh my gosh, like I could not imagine. And I know tragedies and stuff like this happen all the time, but kids waking up in the morning, like, where's dad? Oh, well, he's died and he's not with us anymore.
And I think, you know, some of that is my writing style. Just get to the point if I'm saying something. But I do think that's how a lot of those things are experienced as a child.
Yeah, that's kind of, so true.
And you know, the other thing about it is when I started writing my story, the true storyline of the story is about 3 years of my adult life. There is an adult timeline. When I started looking back, I almost tried to skip over all these sad things.
Really?
Yeah.
Like because, the childhood stuff?
Yes. And because... my motivation for writing the story was not to tell everybody all the sad things that had happened. I thought I'd overcome many of them. And I did notice that I was kind of skipping over the hard parts. So it was kind of leaving my career in TV news, which is what the story is about. That was step one of healing me because I had to break free from some tangles around identity and self-worth. But then in trying to tell that story...
You have to go back.
You have to go back. Yeah. I was already being confronted with these issues that come up in the story in real time. But when I really started to see the parallel of this loss in childhood and how it matched up with kind of a crossroads crisis I was having in my life. Yeah, and I do think it kind of more goes into your subconscious and you don't... fully realize
right.
what something has done to you.
Right. Yeah, I know another big one for me was the abruptness of Cam having to step aside and leave. Like, it was like, oh my gosh, I just wasn't expecting that. And mm-hmm. and gosh, it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Like, how you wrote, the whole book is just
thank you.
Really, really good. How you wrote this, is it just as fresh in your mind? So your grandma passes away. Mm-hmm. You just find out. I slammed the phone into the receiver, fell to the floor. I buried my face in the carpet, beat the ground with my fists. No, 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 no. I pulled the carpet with my fingers, grabbing tiny threads. And I can totally imagine that as a kid trying to grab carpet and you can't. I wanted to rip it up, but there was nothing to hold on to. Like, you have that fresh in your head.
Yes.
I mean, 'cause that's such a detailed representation.
Yes. And I think as a writer, I don't love a lot of description. Actually, maybe even as a reader. If someone spends a lot of time talking about the landscape,
yeah,
I'm like, I get it. Tell me there's some trees.
Right.
You know, I kind
What's
of
the story?
I paint the picture in my head. So I think that's an interesting thing you just pointed out, because I talk about Sean's story. When things happened when I was younger, it was more abrupt. But that is more vivid because I remember it that vividly, and that's because I was a little bit older.
Yeah. When did you decide to have the actual back and forth? Because I thought that was really awesome. You really, for the, at least the first half of the book, mm-hmm. you're reading two stories.
Mm-hmm.
You're reading your childhood story, and then you're reading in the, you know, future. Mm-hmm. And then it all comes together. Like, was that something that you thought of right away, or was that like a later decision?
That's what took so long.
Okay.
Because I had all the present day stuff. In fact, the story started originally in an early draft with the road trip. We're moving to Portland. And then when I started writing it, all the backstory started coming up. But backstory will slow a story down, you know? And so I really had to think about, how am I going to make this work? Because a lot of the backstory is the story.
Yeah.
The backstory informs the story. I spent a lot of time at my dining room table with note cards and scenes, rearranging them, but also figuring out where to cut a scene to start like to go back and forth to even where to cut that one thing. And it, that took a long time.
Yeah.
And actually I studied a lot of memoir and how they did structure. So mine is a hybrid of a couple of things I've seen. And that's why I kind of broke it up into parts. So the reader could sense, okay, we're not doing that anymore. Now the story's just moving forward mm-hmm. more than it's going back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I sort of made up that structure, but it took maybe 14 years.
Right. Yeah. Oh, for sure. So we're gonna jump all over the place because there's so many things. Why don't you give somewhat of a narrative snapshot and then basically the theme of the book? So it's mm-hmm. your job to give people a snapshot, and then it's my job to go all over the place.
Okay, right. Well, I will say that the hardest thing when I was writing it was trying to give a snapshot. It felt so big.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But in terms of just plot, the story is about...
And in all honesty, the book is a snapshot. There's no way you can go
right?
into
it. That's so true. But when I, you know, I started my career in television news, I had these big, big dreams. It never occurred to me. Never occurred to me I'd walk away. And when I finally left, I knew that had changed me in some way. I felt freer. And even as I was going through all of the changes that got me to a place that I could finally walk away, I kept feeling like something's happening. I'm learning things. I'm meeting people who are, they're giving me great advice. I'm learning a lot of life lessons. And so I did, my husband realized, he saw me in my journal and he was like, have you ever thought about writing a book? And this was, I mean, I was still living that story. So I knew that once I left TV news, I had changed in a way that I wanted to tell my story. And at first it felt like a story of work-life balance, finding your passion.
I knew
it was that. I think on the surface, that's what I had found maybe in the short term, but I knew it was deeper. So it really is my desire to tell my story in a way. So it's a unique story, but there are universal threads that I worked very hard to pull out so that if anyone is at a crossroads or is just trying to figure out how to be happy in their life or have more joy. And something I really didn't realize until the end was a lot of it was about the loss and grief that I was carrying. And I thought I had overcome it.
Yeah.
And sometimes we take things into adulthood that have caused pain and scars and trauma, and it's showing up even in your successful life, you know? So I just hope that my story will make people feel something about their own life and feel like they can maybe make a brave choice.
Yeah.
Let some things go.
Yeah. That's funny. I just wrote letting go. I think the letting go that you describe in your book, your story, it represents a general letting go that I think all of us will need to do with something in order to move on to a more fulfilling season of life. Like
That's
there just
right.
has to be there, like
right.
there has to, I think we all do that because there's like a certain aspect of life where we're in this mode of what can I do? What can I produce? What's my resume look like? How many people know who I am? How effective am I? Am I moving up the totem pole at my workplace? And it takes time and big things to happen for you to get to a place where you're like, oh, that stuff isn't the most important stuff in life.
That's right.
And you have to let go in order to do that. And I hate the fact that I think there's probably people that never had anyone to show them how to let go or never went through it, you know, always wanted to go around it. But yeah, I mean, I think the book represents what we all need to do.
Right. And it took me a while to even put language on how I was trying to feel. I was like, is this freedom? But is it freedom from work? Is it freedom from a busy job? But I think freedom is probably as close as I can get to it, where if you're doing all that in your life, but something feels heavy and you know you're carrying something heavy, it's like, what is off? And sometimes it takes a minute to figure out what that is. And it might not just be one thing.
Right.
But imagine carrying a heavy weight and then someone just taking it out of your hands and then you feel the relief. That is what we're talking about.
Right.
In a metaphorical sense.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's a lot of spiritual elements in this. Mm-hmm. And I love how it's just it's just interwoven. It's just a natural part. You probably kept yourself out of the Christian websites because you actually write the words that people are actually thinking and saying, which I love the realness of that. But, you know, you're not going to be able to get in Christian distribution now, Angie. You did yourself in. But here, I think the theme that you're talking about, it is an integral part of a greater gospel message that we don't often think about, and that is the here and now of what God wants for us. You heard a sermon, and it's the disciples, and they're like, what are you talking about? Pick up our stuff and come follow you. And you talked about the fishing was their identity, and that's what they were basing their whole life on for their contentment and their joy and all of that stuff. And even a bigger scripture is, it says, for whoever will save his life shall lose it, and whoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. And that is what your story is. Like, you went through a process of losing what you wanted to hold on so badly, but you learned at a deeper level, this isn't what is going to bring contentment. You lost it and you gained your soul.
That's right.
Right here in the here and now, you have lived your life in a way where you have your soul because you weren't constantly running after the fame. Like that was what you wanted earlier on in life, and you realize, hey, this is not what's going to be fulfilling. I mean, I just think it's huge.
That's right. And I was sensing that the whole time. You know, I did grow up in church, and I found a lot of comfort in high school, in my youth group, and a lot of mentors. And, you know, some things that had me sort of pulling away from the church was just, okay, I'm in college now. Mm-hmm. Can I go to a party and be a Christian? Like, what does this all mean? And when I look back on the bad things I was doing, like in the grand scheme of things, were they really that bad? But I felt, I don't know how to make sense of this. I don't want to be a hypocrite, that kind of thing. But that is a major turning point in my story, in my life, was going to church for guidance in that sermon where the pastor essentially asks, what are your nets?
Right.
And he took a sermon that I'd heard many times about the fishermen who drop their fishing nets to follow Jesus so they can have abundant life. But he turned it on its head where he said, imagine how their identity is so wrapped up in the fact that they catch fish. But imagine, you know, how heavy those nets are. When he turned to us and said, what are your nets? What are the things you're holding on to that you don't want to let go of? That question stayed with me, and it was life-changing.
Right. Your net was to shine in the broadcasting industry and to be famous, to be known. Yeah.
You know, and on the surface it was, because when I asked my mom, I'm like, what are my nets?
Right.
You know?
And
my mom said, I think it's your desire to be famous. And I'm like, that's probably true. But I knew it was deeper than that. First of all, I was gifted in that business. I had skills and talents that allowed me to do that job well. And I did enjoy it to an extent. It's about how when I was experiencing loss in my life, I unknowingly started turning to that praise and turning to the spotlight. It's like I'm feeling a void here in my life. I know how to get the love that I crave.
Right.
I'm going to go do some things in the spotlight that make people proud and love me and praise me. And that is different than I want to be admired for being famous. That is just, I was craving something and I'm like, well, I know how to get it. Mm-hmm. And if I stop doing this, what does my life even mean? You know, I just wanted to be seen and known and validated, that I didn't know how my life would feel meaningful if I wasn't performing in some way.
Right. Right.
And that was my net.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said that you realized at some point that you never were searching for fame. You were searching for home because of all of the loss that you experienced. So you're very straightforward with an alcoholic father. And then you had Cam, who actually adopted you. And then how long did he stay in the home?
In the home 5-7 years
yeah.
from dating my mom to marrying my mom to leaving. But they were married. He was in our house 8 years old to 13.
Yeah. There's a therapist on staff here, and we were just talking, and he was talking about a different situation, but he said that the problem for all of us is that we try to meet a good need just in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. You know, so
that's right.
We all need a home. We all need deeper connections. We all need that. Was your being void of home due to the daddy situation, in and out sort of thing, losing your grandmother and such a horrible time in your life? Like, why do you think the home was missing, that feeling of home?
Well, you see in the early pages of the book that there was this sense of home at my grandparents' house. And that's why when Cam came into our life, I have a line where I say, I didn't even realize anything was missing until I find myself sitting at a dinner table with a mom and someone who can be my dad. At the time, he was my stepdad. And I'm sitting at the dinner table and it just occurs to me, oh, we're a family and I want that. And we did. We had moments where it really felt like I'll hear certain songs on the radio and it... Whatever makes someone feel at home, whether it's a smell, it's a song, it's just, you know, going to somebody's house on Thanksgiving, it was more of a feeling I was going after. And so I do think that family unit falling apart, that was part of it. But then it was almost like several losses in a row. My grandparents die, Cam has left. My mom is finally starting to spin out a little bit because of her loss, and because there wasn't just alcoholism, there was abuse
right.
and things like that that she had never processed. You know, this unprocessed trauma and grief. So all of this is happening while I'm being a teenager. I'm popular. I'm a cheerleader. I make good grades. And so I did. I went. You can go
homecoming
one.
Homecoming queen. Were you homecoming queen?
No, but I was.
Are you sour towards the girl that was? Did she beat you just barely?
Slightly, but she is such. She was the matron of honor of my wedding, and she deserved gotcha. It. She totally did. But I wanted to be homecoming queen.
Did you really?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry for bringing that up. My bad, Angie.
But my senior superlative was most school spirit. If that gives you any idea of the sort of energy I brought to a space, and I was filling the void. She was the secretary at my high school. She came to my book talk, and she was so proud of me. And she was a proponent for me then, but she was like, I just didn't know you seemed so happy. And I said, well, I think in those moments that you were interacting with me, I was. I knew how to find happiness. I would go hang out in your office during my free time, and I just was always searching for that. So, but the key thing is, and this was hard to illustrate in the book, and I really had to dig into what was going on with me. My career aspirations were developing and taking shape as my losses were compounding.
Wow.
And it really was this timing of deciding, you know, I was watching Nancy O'Dell, who went on to Entertainment Tonight. She anchored a morning show here in Charleston when I was a senior. Not only was I watching her, people were saying, you could be like her. In the meantime, I was so lonely at home. And I guess I look back on those times and I remember feeling lonely, but I just never stayed in that place. You know, I hung out with my friends.
Yeah.
I just filled the void.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing wrong with that. You know, it's like, I think that's what most people do. So I had no idea. I thought I had overcome everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like it would have even been more confusing, like when you started to realize, okay, adjustments need to be made. I'm in it for reasons that I don't want to be in it for, but you were also so good at it. Did that conflict you a little bit more that you were so good and lauded and, you know, kind of a local celebrity? I mean,
I'm just seeing this in my head now. Like if you were to track it on a graph, like starting out very green and inexperienced, and then as my experience starts to rise, my desire to do it started to go down, and it did make it hard.
Yeah.
Because in the beginning, well, so it was always hard. But in the beginning, when I was making mistakes and I was so stressed, it was still a means to an end. I still had this goal and this vision of a life I was trying to attain. So I was paying my dues. And then you do start to get better and you start to gain credibility and you actually start to feel like a grown-up. I'm like, oh, I'm a real adult now. And then the desire to do it started to go down, and it took me forever because it almost feels like a shame. It's like, right. Wow, I've worked this hard, and
yeah.
What has happened?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's hard not to think about what other people are thinking about, for sure. You know, as far as like, this was the trajectory of my life, and then all of a sudden, I'm letting go of it, and people asking questions, and why, and mm-hmm. I thought this was what you were made for, and, yeah. And all of that. Yeah.
And I still get that sometimes. Do you miss it? And at this point, I'm like, no.
Right. So I want to go back into some deeper stuff. But before then, as I was reading the book, I think my eyes were open to how much more involved your job is than what I thought. And it's I knew what you did was hard work, but I just thought for sure that you were sent on an assignment, probably given somewhat of a script. You've got things they set up, and then next thing you're holding the microphone, you're on the air, and you know exactly what but it seems more like you need to be in tune with news going on in Charleston. And if you hear about something, you're the one initiating, going out there, getting your camera guy, coming up with a plan of what you're going to say. Like, that's how it felt in the book. I was like, whoa, that's a lot. Like, what did it look like back then? Like, when something breaks, let's just say you hear about a school that's on lockdown and it's kind of a bigger deal than most of those situations. What does Angie do?
So depending on resources and how much a station has in terms of people, and usually there's an assignment desk, you know, so the assignment desk, whoever's working that, they usually assign reporters with the videographer. So, and then in the daytime, there's a morning meeting where the whole team sits down and decides, what are we covering today? So there's a team aspect to it. But as the day progresses, things start happening, news breaks. And when that happens, somebody gets that call. And it's either the reporter finding out or the producer finding out. And then it's just a quick, who's going to do it? Grab your photographer. Let's go. And as a reporter, getting the story is the job. You have to go to the scene. You have to figure out who's going to give you the interviews, making a lot of phone calls. And sometimes you do have support back at the station. Depending on how much upper level management support, sometimes a story happens and you are like, why didn't we know about this? Because when I was a crime reporter, you made beat calls. You just were supposed to be finding out. However you get these scoops and that secret phone call.
Would it help if you had like a friend in the police department?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought I did at that point, like later. And I'm like, well, I guess. We're talking about a scene where I'm like, how do we not know about this? And sometimes you just don't know where the tip came from. And it could have been as simple as a viewer calling that particular station. And maybe it happened so close to news time, you know, and they win, you know, it's like, why do they have that story and nobody else has it?
Right. Right.
It was a terrible feeling.
I mean, you gotta tell me what, like, are there like disastrous moments that you can think of? I think you told one of them, but I mean, like what you did, I can't even like speaking to a live television audience. I mean, we all know what Will Ferrell said when the teleprompter was up on Anchorman, you know, I mean, it's live. Everybody hears it right there. But like, have you ever been on camera and you're just like, I just want to crawl into my bed, crawl into a hole because you messed up or, I mean, it has to happen early in your career.
I have two things that come to mind. Oh my goodness. Well, I have a lot of embarrassing moments where, I mean, I really was in a forest fire and the fire.
Not metaphorically.
I wasn't in a burning fire, but we were
but
in
were
the
there.
Forest. The fire official's like, the fire is contained. And I'm like, but he said, we still have to keep an eye on it. I'm like, so what you're saying is we're not out of the woods yet. And it was the next day I was curling my hair to go to work. And I was like, oh, I said, we're not out of the woods yet. And when I walked into the newsroom, everyone was like, Mazelle, we're not out of the woods yet. But
do you think people took that as that's a really insensitive joke? She shouldn't joke around about this forest fire.
I have no idea. But when I played the tape back, even the fire official was like, that's correct. It was terrible. But no, there were a lot of times. And then there are other times that it's easier than you think because you get used to it.
Right.
You know? But anyway.
Yeah. read another passage, and it's that you say, what were we even doing right now? In the back of my mind, I had this gnawing feeling that I was running out of time. Like I didn't have a right to be there enjoying myself when there was still so much to figure out. I didn't realize that the very thing I resisted, letting things be unresolved and relaxing into the moment, was the thing I needed the most. I needed to awaken my senses and experience simple pleasures without shame or guilt for not doing something more productive with my life. I just love that. And it's crazy how productivity and busyness is a badge of honor nowadays. Like if somebody says how you're doing and you're like, oh man, just super, super busy. Like the reaction I think for most people is like, oh, okay, well that's cool. That's you're doing something. And just recently, I'd say in the last couple of years, I have been able to, and it's not like I've been a deadbeat father. I've been very involved with the kids' lives, but in my head, I wasn't enjoying it like I could, because it's like, okay, this is family time, but there's so many things that I could be doing, so many things I could be producing and editing and getting this done and getting that done. I wasn't super present. And now I love the thought that if I look at my calendar right now, outside of some kid activities, I have nothing going on tonight. And my plan is to just be present at home. I mean, just to be present at home. But that is such a freeing thing. But wouldn't you agree that nowadays it's kind of like that's not really celebrated?
Just being present?
As far as not having busyness, and actually it's not necessarily a value.
Right.
You know, like if someone says, hey, how are you doing? What you been up to? I've been very disconnected from work stuff and just taking a lot of downtime. That statement in itself, you're like, oh, you're kind of lazy. Well, no, what if that person's taking time off and recharging?
That's right. That's right. And my husband, Sean, and I have talked about this. We're more aligned than we come across. We have different personalities. Yeah. But he likes to use the line, yeah, I'm super busy, because he uses that to set boundaries with people of like, don't expect a call back from me, that kind of thing. I don't like to use that as an excuse because I don't want to be seen as super busy. I'd rather my life be seen as full. We are learning, and through having a husband like Sean, that you can be very busy and present, you know, but you have to take those moments when they're there.
Yeah.
You know, our kids are very busy after school. We may have one night a week that we're all in the same room for dinner, and it might be 15 minutes, but then it's like sometimes if we find somebody on their phone, we're like, put your phone away. Like we're hanging out.
Right.
it's more of a conscious effort, and you just have to keep practicing because we're being present right now. You know, that is something I've learned. If I'm driving and I'm not texting or I can be present while I'm driving my car.
Right.
You know, so
my therapist has said this line many times. She's just like, when you're washing the dishes, enjoy just washing those dishes. You just be present.
Yeah. And maybe you don't enjoy it, but you could experience it, like just even noticing how the water feels,
right?
Because it takes your brain out of what it's like. My brain's always trying to solve every problem all the time, and that's why I can't relax.
Yeah,
but if you're in the moment, there's rarely a problem in the moment,
right?
I mean, sometimes there is,
right,
but rarely.
Yeah, I mean, reading your memoir, like thinking about the age that you were going through all this, it really seems to me, and this will probably be a tougher question to answer because you don't want to be braggy, Angie, but it seems like you learned some pretty deep foundational life truth / lessons that I can say personally took me well into my 40s to learn. And you're going through all of this in your 30s. Like, wouldn't you agree that some of the stuff that you learned, you were given a gift of learning it at a very young age?
I think that's why I saw the book through, as hard as it was, because
that makes sense. Yeah.
So a couple of things were happening, which is usually what's happening in my brain. Two things at one time. As I was going through it, it felt profound. Even on the worst days, I'm like, I feel like I'm unraveling, but maybe this isn't bad. And I was turning to my journal a little bit. So this inclination to kind of document some moments that was there. And I also know it because people have told me I blogged a lot when my kids were young. And I've had a lot of people 10, 20 years older than me just say it in my blog comments. And maybe that's even why people not necessarily in my stage of life, would read my stuff. There is this theme. You had asked earlier about, like, what is the theme? And I used to say, and I don't like it, but it's like redefining success. But I had to untangle from what we as a whole think it means to be successful.
Yeah.
And that I was already parenting through that lens. And you can still have goals and you can still work very hard. It's just a different approach to it when you're not going after it from a place of lack or feeling like you have to prove yourself. You know, that, and it's kind of heady stuff. You almost, it's something you have to feel and experience to understand.
Right.
But yeah, I do feel like that is why I wrote a book, because I was untangling in a way I never imagined.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I would say in a lighthearted, envious way, I mean, I would imagine, you know, your 35 to 45 looked, was a lot better. And I don't mean situationally, but I would imagine having gone through what you went through, probably had a lot more peace than a typical 35 to 45 year old like myself. That's just a guess, because that's some deep stuff, stuff you worked through.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have peace, not, I don't know, comparatively, right. But I did feel pretty okay.
Yeah. How has all of this affected, because it's not talked about specifically in the book. I mean, there's no really need to. So this is more of just like a friend to a friend. Like, how have you changed in your outlook on money? Because that's something that can trip a lot of people up. That's another one of those recent in my 40s things that I have found myself on the other side of. You know, like, I spent most of my adult life, if my bank account looks good, then I'm at peace. You know, if everything's going well, then I'm happy, you know, financially. Mm-hmm. Like, my stability emotionally was somewhat linked to finances, which, that's nothing that you can depend on. It could change at the snap of a finger, you know?
Right.
Like, how do you do with that nowadays?
Well, when I was in my television career, money and getting more of it was a balm for working harder. It's like there has to be a payoff at the end. So I don't know if that's necessarily a good, it wasn't a good path for me, because I understand math and I know how to pay my bills. So I just want to be clear about that I've got really good credit. Like, I know how to do that, but money doesn't motivate me. Like, what's going to make me get up every day and work really hard? It has to be something else. And then if money comes, and if you believe in your value, to me, that's more about learning to live in abundance. I know some people are more motivated by money than others.
Right.
For me, what I tell my kids, I don't ever want to be your dream crusher. But you may need to have some side hustles, because you can pursue anything you want to, but you will also have to figure out how to pay your bills.
Right.
And now that we're a dual income family, and we are, I'll just say this openly, my husband is more of the breadwinner. Mm-hmm. If I had stayed on the same path, we would have been a dual income. I mean, who knows how much money we would have right now. And I've also had professional work where I was able to keep us afloat while he was in a transition. So in our house, I'm fortunate that we have two adults, but there's enough. Like, if I can pay my bills and we have a little savings, then I'm almost at a place where I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, but that's different for everybody, as long as it's not tangled up in your self-worth. But I think also some people are motivated by money, and that's okay.
Right.
I mean, I sort of feel that way too.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You had to make a really tough decision when it comes to Cam and John both being, well, and it eludes me, was it your wedding?
It was my wedding.
It was your wedding. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, John is your biological father. Mm-hmm. And basically Cam, you refer to him as your father, Cam, your father who adopted you, had to tell you that, listen, you're going to make your own decision, but it's either him or me. And it was not, at least how I read it, it wasn't in a snotty, if he comes and I'm not coming. It was because he knew what that would do to your mom. Mm-hmm. And so you were put in a position, and I don't mean that in a bad way, like that's, but you had to make a call that would hurt someone that you care about, but it was out of loyalty to the people you were connected with. Mm-hmm. And I have been through a tumultuous journey when it comes to friendships. And there was a need, like in our circle of friends, I needed some of my friends not to hate the other guys, not to, you know, be even mad at them, but I needed some of them to be like, in this situation, you're not the one that's messing up. Like we've got your back. Mm-hmm. They understand the situation. They know my perspective. They know what those other guys are saying. And I feel like I have camaraderie. And that's what it seems like your mom needed from you. And I would say as a very reasonable thing in her heart to need, but you know, walk us through that.
So that scene, and it's so surprising because it does carry a lot of depth. It was hard to write, and it's maybe two whole pages out of the book.
Angie style.
Angie style. We're just going to. There is a lot of layers there because my loyalty has always been to my mom, and that loyalty was never out of any obligation. She was my mom. And my loyalty was to Cam because he was the father that I longed for. You know, I longed for him. So in that moment, I almost felt like he was stepping up and stepping in and maybe doing something he should have done a long time ago. You know, I feel like I was sort of left alone. This is how it felt to me to navigate this relationship with my biological father. And I was always coming at life like, I don't want to hurt anybody. So I'm willing to listen to John apologize and make amends. And I have to live with myself at the end of the day. I'm not going to turn somebody away who's trying to make things right. Into adulthood, John and I have continued to have a relationship. I'll say we don't write at the moment because the book coming out was kind of hard. But he knows my kids. But it has always been a source of stress because I've had to keep that area of my life separate. But what's really important for me and what I want people to understand is part of the story was about me untangling from everybody else's feelings so that I could figure out how I felt. Mm-hmm. So I actually knew where my true loyalties were. And this was the hardest part, to have a relationship with John in any form. I can understand to my mom why it felt like a betrayal, but to me it was not. It's like, this is somebody I have to come to my own peace and figure out what forgiveness looks like for me. But it was hard. And I think that there is the line where I say, I have a conversation with John. And even though our relationship in the book doesn't go any further, I tell him I forgive him. I hope that he can forgive himself. And I finally become my own advocate. Like, I needed this adult advocate for me in this regard, but I finally learned how to do it for myself. So that meant having a relationship with all three of them in my own way. Mm-hmm. And it did not mean that everybody came together at the holidays. It meant that I had to find my own peace in my own life. And I do feel like I've had that. I do think sometimes there's fallout in telling your story.
Right.
But there was no malice in telling the story.
Right. Right. Yeah, that had to have been hard for sure. For sure. Once you forgave your dad, once you forgave John, did it ever turn into like a very naturally flowing love? Like,
So this is something I realized later. I think a lot of these discovering how you feel inside is a process.
Yeah. Which when you were talking, Angie, it just made me realize how ill-equipped kids are when it comes to the relational dynamics of parents getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, kids are just developing. They don't even have a deeper level of you know, critical thinking when it comes to social stuff. And here they are thrown in the middle of, and that's why it's so important. Sorry for cutting you off. It's so important that parents, no matter what the other person is doing, doesn't poison the water of the other person, because it's just no good for the kids. It's just no good at all. Like,
and I imagine that John has felt that way, but I know for a fact that this story is really pulled largely from my memories and some basic fact checking. So in the situation with John, I did not have that initial attachment. It never formed for me as a child. So that was the difference.
That makes sense.
Though there was a curiosity about the person you may look like, you know, it's your blood, it's your DNA. I did, as I got older, there was a curiosity about knowing this person, especially once he got sober. You know, because I never think someone is all bad. You know, and I always understood later in life that there were things going on with him that was causing rage and causing just, but in my formative years, there was no attachment. So the relationship that we had was more of a, maybe to call it peers would be, I just feel like I was an adult.
Yeah, no,
and,
that makes
and
sense.
He sort of respected the wisdom that I was bringing to the table because he knew I had done a lot of work.
Right.
So it was always a relationship of, you're in my life, but there are boundaries, but it's not because I'm thinking poorly of you.
Yeah.
It's just like, this is just the history we're coming from. So let's try to make this work.
Yeah.
I've since learned that that doesn't, as much as you may, and maybe in my own way, that's how I was trying to fix things.
I wanted to throw this in there. I love that you, because I could totally relate to this. At one point, you really picked up on a message from God, and it was from probably someone that you nor myself would naturally be geared up to be influenced by. It was like a televangelist or something like that. And you're watching it how I would watch it too, with just kind of some skepticism and, you know, cynicism or whatever. And then God drops a bomb on your lap, something that this guy said. And I just, that to me, those are those moments where I'm like, well, I know that was from God because I don't really care what this person has to say.
That's right. And it was about forgiveness,
right.
You know, and I just feel like truth is truth. And when you're hearing truth and it's the truth is coming to you at a time that you have received it, it hits different. And you know, like, oh, wait, but what just came out of his mouth is true.
Yeah.
And I was meant to hear it at that moment.
Yeah. So how do you do now, having gone through all of this, when it cut, like I, someone told me this one time, it was so helpful. They said, it's none of your business what other people think about you. How do you navigate that now as a, I think you said 49-year-old, 49?
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate that? Because that's something that I don't know if we ever just completely overcome. Maybe some people do. I don't know.
I absolutely care what people think.
Right.
I really do. And so how I've reconciled that later in life is you have to get honest with yourself and you really have to know who you are. And if you're a spiritual person, you have to be in a relationship with God so that you feel as good as you can about the path you're on in life. So I just know that it's my nature, again, to not hurt anybody. Like, I'm not trying to hurt somebody. I understand that sometimes, like, putting a book out might hurt a few people, but that wasn't what I was trying to do. So, and I try to be conscientious, and I try to see the big picture. So I'm already bringing all of that to the table, you know. So if you know, I'm trying, and some people... Let's just use the book for the example. I mean, this is the most vulnerable thing I've ever done in my life, but not doing it was not an option.
Right.
I have received so much praise, and I have not yet received the negative, but I know it's there. I had to just work through that and remember why I did it, who it's for, and I would be willing to have a conversation with anybody, you know? So what I started to realize is I'm actually scared that people are going to be downright mean, or that people I love or care about, that people will turn away from me. And so I had to face once again my fear of loss. But it's like, is my fear of loss going to keep me from walking my path? And I finally decided, no. It's almost like, can we just be blissfully ignorant that people aren't happy with you? That part's never easy, but that's how I've learned to ground myself. And then I don't make making everybody happy the motivating factor.
Yeah.
And when I catch myself doing it, so I still do it.
Right.
But I catch myself and then I realize, wait, you need to back up and reframe this and make sure you're doing this or not doing this for the reasons, because you didn't come this far.
Right.
To act like you didn't learn anything.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I think that's where the growth is in. It's not whether or not I have overcome something. It's how quick is my response cycle to reframe it. Like you said, you got to stop and be like, okay, wait a second. I'm attributing something to this that I don't need to be. And you do the thinking through of it. And I know for me, there's been certain things where I've done that enough and people told me this was going to happen. And I was like, I want to experience that. But you do that recalibrating enough. And then that thought, there's a new well-worn path to where it doesn't go to something that you get anxious about or down about. It goes to that more healthy path. And that's how I am with money. Like every time I worried about money, I had to slow down and be like, okay, money, when it comes to the most important things in this world, it's mm-hmm. is nothing. I'm going to be okay. That's not what's important. You know, I had to tell myself, and now when I have like a money stressful thought, it goes right to, oh, that's not, doesn't matter. Like, you know, I'm responsible with my money. I'm doing the best that I can. Outside of that, it's out of my control.
Right. And that primitive part of our brain is just, we've worked that more, yeah. You know, that muscle.
Yeah. Three more questions for you. You got time?
Yeah, of course.
All right, sweet. You'll know what I mean by this. Do you ever have any what if Memphis thoughts today? Like, is that something that you know, for lack of better words, will fantasize about? So would you consider Memphis the crossroads where that was the real beginning of you not going the trajectory that you originally thought? I mean, that wasn't when you were sure of things by any means, but do you see that as like a pretty significant juncture and not taking that?
Not taking that job in Memphis. Yes, it absolutely set the trajectory for my marriage and everything that we were going to do from that point forward. When I was writing that scene, I did pause, and I, looking back, know every real part of me did not want to go. I have wondered, so actually I feel like, wow, that might have been the first exercise in me actually listening to my heart and God, even when I didn't know why. But I have wondered, what if I was at a decision, a crossroads like that, and I was a little more healed? You know, would it have been as difficult of a decision?
Right.
I think the only reason there's any what if is because I had so much work to do still, that it's hard not to have a what if. Like, what if I had already done all that inner work? And we were talking before about reconciliation and with people, and what we were just talking about earlier about our brains. I think I've come to realize that people see life through a different lens, and that's okay. So sometimes people are just coming at it from their own history. They see the world completely different. I don't think we're ever all the way healed. But some people are less healed than others, mm-hmm. and it makes true connection difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. It had to have been the most therapeutic thing. And I bet a lot of times in a good way, and a lot of times in a good way, but it was hard just writing this book, revisiting all of that stuff.
It was.
Up until writing the book, had you figured out how to have sympathy for little Angie? Like, have you found any health in being like, man, my heart breaks for young Angie? Because I think of myself as a kid and the sort of, me personally, some traumatizing things with the religious affiliation that I was in. Mm-hmm. And I really feel bad for that little Joey that was carrying so much heavy religiosity. And I was way too young to be thinking that kind of stuff. So I feel mm-hmm. bad for little Joey in a compassionate way. It's kind of a weird deal, but have you connected with like your yeah. younger self and felt
Yes, and it is sympathy? A hard exercise, because at first it feels a little weird, you know? It's right. like, I don't know, right. what are we
right.
doing?
It's not another person, it's me.
Yeah, and then, do you know, that is something that I'm still working on, but it is helping me stay strong in certain areas, because I'm still learning how to be the advocate for the little girl who felt like everything was her fault, who felt like it was her job to make people happy, to fix all the things, to be the peacemaker for the whole family, you know, to be the adult. And I don't think anybody intentionally put that on me, but I still have to remind myself, even when things go wrong now, you didn't necessarily cause this, you know, and then I have to stand up for the little girl.
Yeah.
And if I did cause it, then I own up to stuff. But yeah, and I think that is this next stage of work, is becoming an adult that the child in me can actually count on. You know, I have to show up for myself.
Right.
And I don't mean that in a non-godly, non-spiritual way. I feel like God calls us to do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. love mm-hmm. others as you love yourself. That's the mm-hmm. part that we don't say. Mm-hmm. We say love God, love others. It's like, yeah, as you love yourself. Let's just say you got famous now. Like, we look at all these young stars and we're like, how pathetic. I can't believe they're doing such a lot. I'm like, they're 21 years old mm-hmm. and they just inherited millions of dollars and more fame than it, you know, like, how would you deal with that as mm-hmm. a 21-year-old? Would fame intimidate you at this later stage in life, as far as like, oh, how do I navigate this? Or do you think, having gone through what you've gone through, it would not be something that would be so challenging?
I don't know if any of us are wired at a soul level for fame. So there is a part of me that's afraid of it.
Ooh, and I like that. So you're not so sure any of us are naturally wired to vibe with fame.
Except maybe Dolly Parton. Like, she yeah, seems to be true. Like, I am famous and I know that's perfect my responsibility. Example. She almost carries that in how she interacts with yeah. other people. But I think most of us have a hard time when we really realize, oh, people think I'm something and I'm still me. I think it's a lot of input. And I'm actually glad that it didn't happen when I was younger and I didn't rise to the level, because I don't know if I could have handled it. I don't know if I published the book 10 years ago if I could have handled it. I just have to stay kind of grounded in what I want more than fame is you want to make an impact, right? You want to feel like if I've told this story, it's reaching who it's supposed to reach. But I don't know how to measure that, because I used to say, if one person tells me, I was so moved by your book, well, I've gotten that. So then it's like, okay, so now do I raise it to 10 people? You know, what, you know, what's enough? So I think I've decided that if I keep my motivation around, it's about being in any opportunity I can to talk about my story and other people's stories, and let that ripple effect and become whatever it becomes. If I just stay committed to that, then whatever comes of it, and if it is fame, whatever that means, but like a lot of people, a lot of eyeballs on me, then I'll just have to trust that I need to rise to that.
Right.
But I don't think I could have done it. It's a lot
yeah.
for people
yeah,
to
for
deal
sure.
with.
For sure. Well, I mean this sincerely, that I will never have navigated through all of the challenges of the human experience. And so even things that I feel like I've come a long way in, there were many things in your book that was encouraging for me just to hear the truth that played out in your life and to be able to say, yeah, that's what Angie's saying about her life. These are universal truths mm-hmm. that, you know, if we can walk through, I think all of us would be a lot deeper. So thank you for writing your story. Is there a spotlight too? Girl in the Spotlight 2. Do you want to think about a new book now?
Well, you know, people do say, what's next? I do have a couple of book ideas, but I joke with my kids. I'm like, maybe it won't take 14 years. Maybe it'll take 7. But
and tell people what you do now.
So,
because you got into training, professional training.
Yes. So I've done a lot of things since leaving TV, but I've done everything from run a PR marketing company to be a personal trainer but I actually don't do any of that now, because now I am so excited to be in this place of being an author. That was a bigger dream. It ended up becoming like the biggest dream. It felt like a calling mm-hmm. on my life. So I actually feel like for the next year or two, I need to be focused on this message. I've thought about maybe doing a podcast, mm-hmm. whatever opportunities I can speak and be in conversations. I also write a weekly newsletter called Hello Friday. Mm-hmm. And that's where I sort of create a community, like the people that can be in conversation with me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. We'll put that in the show notes.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Angie, for sharing your story and your book and right here at this table.
This was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy these episodes, we'd love for you to leave us a rating and maybe even a comment. We've loved the comments that have come in so far. There's also a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook group where we talk about these episodes and we share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests that we're booking. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.